Australia is no stranger to drought, but in recent times we've seen extreme water scarcity and it's devastating whole rural communities. Climate change is likely to increase that dryness too, and that's going to affect not only people living on the land, but everyone else relying on it for food and fibre. Australia's first peoples thrived on this country for thousands of years, building up complex and environmentally sensitive land and water use practices. But how well is that knowledge listened to and acted on these days? Bruce Pascoe is a Bunurong, Yuin and Tasmanian man who's also a farmer and author, and one of his most influential books is Dark Emu, which documents the highly sophisticated agriculture and aquaculture practices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Bruce, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you very much.
Now, you brought to light the many complex and organised food and fibre cultivation practices that existed at the point of colonisation. Since your book was first published 5 years ago, have you noticed any changes in the conversation around water and land use?
I think there is a change. Farmers in particular have become aware that their profitability is plummeting as a result of drying conditions, and many of those farmers are looking for alternatives. So to that extent, there is a change in the conversation, but we've got a long way to go because every summer in the last few years, we've been throwing our hands in the air because fish are dying in the river and we can't understand it. And, you know, we should be just thinking, what does a fish need? Fish needs water. There's none there, they're dying. So we have to radically change the way we do agriculture in this country.
And Bruce,
it's not going to be total change, but we, you know, we do have to bite the bullet and realise that we're in a dry country, have been for 230 years, and it's about time we started to listen to how the old people managed this ancient dry land.
And Bruce, you're also a farmer. Tell me what kind of conversations you've been having with farmers in your area about your approach to farming and how perhaps things could change for the better in your area.
Well, there's a bit of amusement, really. I got rid of the cows. I'm starting to grow Australian grains and tubers, and Australians are very unfamiliar with them. But I think the people in marginal country, and this is not marginal country here, this is, you know, probably the most reliable rainfall in Victoria. People on marginal lands have told me that they're transitioning into perennial grain crops. And even though the yields per acre are less than they had for wheat, they're able to make a profit for the first time in 30 years, simply because they've reduced their chemical bill, which was their major line item in their whole economy, and they've reduced their reliance on irrigation. This is a positive thing for them. They're very happy. They say that they're working half as hard as they used to because they're not putting in the tractor hours for ploughing and irrigation, and it's good for the country because we need to understand where we live. We need to understand the history of this country and understand its geography and stop pretending that we're living in Kent and start planting plants that are sympathetic to this country, Australian plants.
And so, Bruce, you've been having a lot of conversations on a personal level, on a micro level. What about at the macro level when it comes to policy development? Are you starting to be able to have more conversations with politicians?
Yeah, politicians are becoming interested in these ideas. Dark Emu was the first book chosen for the parliamentary reading list, and that's encouraging. And I'm looking forward to you know, more conversations with government. But government are always responsive to people, or they should be, and the people are changing their mind. Australians who live on the land understand their situation and are looking for alternatives. Not all farmers, obviously. Farmers on good land where the rainfall's predictable are continuing to do what they're doing. But, you know, read the papers at the weekend, last weekend, and you'll hear that dairy farmers are leaving the Riverina district, you know, which was such a prosperous country, but they're leaving because there's no water. And things like almonds and rice and cotton are stealing the water from them. And we have to understand that if we're growing cotton in this country, we just don't have the water for it. And nor is it good for those light soils in the around the Brewarrina area and western New South Wales to be continually ploughed. I've just come back from there and I drove through 100 kilometres of dust. It wasn't dust, it was our soil, Australia's capital, I was driving through. And we can't do that. We've lost metres and metres of soil in the last 230 years. No good capitalist wants to lose their capital, and that's what's happening.
We're speaking with Bruce Pascoe, who's a farmer and author of the hugely influential book Dark Emu. We're also joined by Bradley Mogridge. He's a Kamilaroi water scientist and a PhD candidate at the University of Canberra. Bradley, welcome.
Yama, how are you going?
Well, thanks. Let's shift our gaze to the academic world for a moment. You recently co-edited a special edition of the Australasian Journal of Environmental Management, and that was devoted to Indigenous water management. Do you feel like that's a hopeful sign that perhaps perspectives are opening up to include Indigenous voices?
Oh, look, I definitely think it's a bit of a game changer, like Uncle Bruce's Dark Emu. You know, it's the first of its kind. In academic world, you know, we even had an abstract written in a language, an Indigenous language. So, you know, that's a real first for a scientific journal. I think it's very opportunistic that hopefully, you know, more research is done. It's really just the tip of the iceberg. And when we think about water management and knowledge, our knowledge is not really taken as knowledge or a science. It's taken as myth and legend, and I suppose we need to move on from that. And I suppose providing credible evidence like journal papers and you know, infiltrating science with traditional knowledge, I think is a good start.
And as you say, you're arguing that cultural connections to water can provide the basis of better water management for this dry continent. Tell us how this might work in a few practical examples.
Well, I suppose when we sort of look at the historical aspect of this country, you know, we're the driest inhabited continent on Earth, and we have one of or the oldest living culture on the planet. So thousands and thousands of years of observation and testing the environment to make sure that it's sustainable activities, especially for the water source. You know, if there's no surface water, your knowledge of groundwater has to be pretty darn good to understand of where your next drink of water is going to be. And I suppose if water holes dry up or rivers dry up, those deep water holes or groundwater sources are your only aspect in survival. So the value of water for Indigenous people is a lot higher than we put on it today. You know, our value of water today of water is a dollar value, which is quite sad.
And this week on the ABC's Q&A program, Water for the Rivers activist Bruce Shillingsworth spoke very eloquently, very powerfully about how this lack of water is affecting Indigenous people. Let's hear a little of what he had to say.
So a lot of the First Nation people are leaving their tribal, their lands that they've been, you know, that they lived on for thousands and thousands of years. How do we bring back the 50-year-old cods? How do we bring back the freshwater mussels? How do we bring back the aquatic life, the ecosystem, and the animals that relied on the river and the water? They are now completely dead. They're extinct. This has happened over the last 100 years. Australia needs to wake up. I'm listening tonight. We're listening to... There's two things that I can hear. It's water and profit. Why are we selling water to make profit? That's what I'm hearing. And here, my people on the river that relied on those animals for the food source for thousands of years are now dying. This is the second wave of genocide.
So Bradley Mogridge, powerful words there. Revaluing water in ways that don't involve money would be a big shift for Australia's current economic system and non-Indigenous society generally. What could that look like? What are some steps that the federal government could take there?
Yeah, it is a big shift. And, you know, we've gone through massive reforms early 2000s to separate land and water. And, you know, for starters, a lot of our old people don't get that. Without water, the land is nothing. And I suppose without healthy water, you know, culture is nothing and human well-being is nothing. So I think that separation was a big shift, and then that created the water market. So it's going to take and maybe Australia responds to crisis. And I think we're on the brink of an unbelievable crisis. And, you know, the science is sort of suggesting that, you know, there could be ecological collapse. And as we move into uncharted territories, the new normal is a drought. And, you know, it might rain. You know, we had the Millennium Drought, which is one of the worst on record. And now we're straight into another drought. And this is only in the last 20 years. So what does that mean for our future? You know, is this the new normal? And I think we need to look at how we value water, but also how we manage water and that share of water. And from an Indigenous point of view, we just don't have a share. Advance Australia share, I say. We don't share, we don't have a right to water. The historical aspects, put it this way, you know, Water Management 101, when our people were on missions and reserves, their whole life was dominated by the mission manager. You know, that's my mum's generation and Nan's generation, grandparents' generation. So, you know, it's not that long ago. And when we became, let's say, human, all the good land and water was gone. And now we're in a point where if we want water, we've got to go to the market and buy it.
And Bradley, the Murray-Darling Basin Management Authority has appointed a permanent Indigenous board member. But beyond that, what's your perspective on the current debates around water use, for example, including the Murray-Darling Basin? Are Indigenous voices at the table enough there?
Oh, look, there are voices there. And, you know, we have two Indigenous groups in the Murray-Darling Basin, Northern Basin Aboriginal Nations, which is, you know, represents my part of the basin in the northern part, and Mildren Murray Lower Darling Rivers Indigenous Nations. And, you know, they're two voices that advise the authority and have a say in water. But when it comes to the board position, you know, that's fantastic. That's an acknowledgement that there is a gap. But that there's going to be a lot of pressure on that person, no doubt, male or female. You know, there's men's and women's business in water business. And I think, you know, only having one sex is a challenge as well. So, or one gender, I should say. But also, when we look at the last fish kills, you know, the Aboriginal people weren't seen, our knowledge holders and weren't seen as experts. We weren't put up front with those scientists because, you know, as I said earlier, our knowledge is only seen as myth and legend, but, you know, it is a science that we understand this country. And I think that the science needs to also accommodate Indigenous knowledge as well. You know, we looked at the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, credible evidence and best available science was used, and at the moment all we got in the Murray-Darling Basin Plan is regard. That's probably not enough for us. It's probably saying something lightly. I think we, you know, as we build evidence and like that special edition in Australian Journal of Environmental Management, Australian Journal of Environmental Management, is a start. You know, we're starting to build some data and some language around Indigenous knowledge, and I think it's the more we do it, but I suppose the other challenge is we need more people in this space, the Indigenous science space. There's not many of us, and, you know, we need to start filling those gaps as well. We need to step up.
Bruce Pascoe, if I can come back to you for a moment. When we think about the custodial role that Indigenous people have had for millennia, how does it affect people to see things like mass fish deaths and degradation of ecosystems on their country?
Well, it hurts Aboriginal people to see the harm being done to animals and the land. The land's our mother. You know, it's our responsibility as Aboriginal people to look after the land. And it's painful to watch it being damaged in this way. You know, Australia says it's a commonwealth. Our wealth is held in common. But here we are selling water. Things like water, air and soil should be part of our commonwealth. We should never allow them to become market values. And I think that's one of our problems at the moment. But we do need to concentrate our minds on the fact that we live in Australia and that we need to accommodate for the climate here and the geography. And, you know, throughout the generations of occupation here, you know, we've always talked about drought, you know. We admire the outback drover and all his hardships. But really, when people like Sir Thomas Mitchell and Charles Sturt and Ashwin and people like that were travelling through the country, they were riding their horses through grass that was higher than their saddle. We have to remember that this country is productive, but the plants that were grown there were Australian plants, and they had been domesticated by Aboriginal people, and there was always enough water. One year might be drier than the last, but we weren't talking about drought, because drought is a term that only an Englishman understands. Aboriginal people just adapted.
On the Q&A program on Monday, we heard a lot of that framing of the debate as between environmental flows and farming, and it's often phrased in that way, particularly from the Farmers Federation. Bradley Moggridge, is that necessary, or can you both be winners, irrigation farming and environmental flows?
That's a massive challenge, I suppose, with the water market the way it is. It's hard to manage the environment and to get its fair share. So I suppose the Water Act itself gave the environment a right to have water. And I suppose the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, on paper, may be a good plan, but I suppose it's up to the states then to build on that. And I think if the states aren't pulling their weight, or they're actually having provisions in their legislation that actually break down that the working of the plan, then the plan's not going to work. Environmental flows are a key part of keeping the river alive. You know, that's the idea, is keeping our rivers alive and our groundwater replenished. And as we move into to drier and sort of uncertain areas, you know, the keeping the rivers alive is going to be important. And, you know, Bruce Shillingsworth spoke about, you know, people are leaving their country because it's the rivers are dry, there's no food resources. You know, these rivers were sustaining our people for thousands of generations. You know, the wetlands are our supermarkets. And I think that, you know, part of this conversation is that Indigenous knowledge is not part of that. And, you know, we need to move on from not seeing it as a mumbo jumbo storytelling. It's more about celebrating some of the oldest knowledge on the planet. You know, we don't do that well in Australia. And Bruce talked about that just then, you know, is that we don't see our knowledge as a key part of managing our landscapes. And I think there's a future. A future has to have Indigenous knowledge, and especially the way we look at the Australian landscape.
We've got a couple of minutes left of our discussion this morning. Bradley, are there some state governments that are doing better, in your opinion, than others on this issue?
Oh, look, I used to lead an Aboriginal Water Unit in New South Wales, and a change of leadership in that department saw us disbanded. I had 10 Aboriginal staff around the state, and we were doing magnificent stuff, I believe. We're having impact. And, you know, New South Wales went back to the 1960s, 50s or whatever, 1920s, let's say, which was sad. And, you know, I could have retired in that position. But Victoria has committed, you know, in Water for Victoria, and they have committed funds to that, to create an Aboriginal water unit, but also create opportunities for Aboriginal people to engage in the water market through the fund. Northern Territory has reintroduced strategic Aboriginal reserves, which was put off the table a number of years ago under a previous government in the Northern Territory. Now a new government come in and they put it back on, and now it's legislated. There's a framework. So and that gives Indigenous people in the Northern Territory a right to the consumptive pool. And whether they use it for economic purposes or just leave it in the rivers, you know what I mean? So it's the governance is purely up to them, which is exciting.
And Bruce Pascoe, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share on the water use in Australia?
I think we need to think about it as a country, and it's not about demeaning farmers or demeaning Australia in general. And neither is it about demeaning Aboriginal people or forgetting that 120,000 years of knowledge of the country is a useful scientific tool for the rest of the country to use. We have to have a broad and generous conversation about how we live on this land and how we prosper together. And I really don't want to be on the back of a tractor most of my days, and that's what's happening at the moment. But I'm doing it because I think there's going to be a revolution in agriculture in this country, and I want Aboriginal people to be part of it. I don't want us to be dispossessed again just because people have had a brainwave and start growing perennial grains and perennial tubers and reacting to Australia as if it was Australia. I want Aboriginal people to be part of that prosperity, and I really fear that in all the enthusiasm for what Australians like to call bush tucker, what I like to call food, that Aboriginal people will be dispossessed again. And so I think it's really important for Australia, when they think environment, when they think agriculture, they also think, how can Aboriginal people be part of this prosperity?
Bruce, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters. And Bradley Mulgridge, wonderful to have you with us too. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Bruce Pascoe is a Bunurong, Yuin and Tasmanian man who's also a farmer and the author of many books, including the very wonderful Dark Emu. And Bradley Mulgridge is a Kamilaroi water scientist and a PhD candidate at the University of Canberra.